Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Well, hey everyone, hunting season is officially here. We've both been out in the stand for this October cold front that's moved through. Don Higgins, I'm Terry Peer. We're brought to you by Osseo Gear. This episode will air on October 12th. Don, let's get a recap of your last week, everything from cows and preparing for this cold front and youth season. What you been up to, buddy?
Well, I've had a busy week. I didn't hunt the first, I think it was 7 days of season. I don't think I've ever waited 7 days to go hunting once season opened, but I did this year because it was so stinking hot. But then we had a cold front come through, and I hunted 3 evenings in a row and seen deer every evening. First evening, I only seen a doe and a fawn. Next evening, I seen, two little bucks, a yearling and a two-year-old, and a doe and a fawn. And then the last evening, I seen 2 3-year-old bucks, a yearling, and a doe and a fawn. So they were moving, but to be honest, all the movement I seen was like right at dark. I mean, the last 30 minutes of shooting light. So big ones aren't moving. I will say that I thought I was going to kill Turning Point the first hunt out. I was sitting in his area where he's at, and shoot, I had that 2.5-year-old buck came by, and so he was the first deer I seen that evening. But back in the brush, like less than 100 yards from me, there was a big old buck just working over a tree. And I mean, you can tell by the sound if it's a little buck or a big set of antlers working over a bush. And there was a big buck working it over, and it's not a spot where there's a lot of deer anyway, so if it wasn't him, I didn't know what other buck it could potentially been. So, but he never showed. I sit there and just nothing. And I
got your blood pressure up a little bit though.
Oh, I was ready. I had the bow in hand and the camera was focused where it needed to be, just ready to flip it on. And
there's no better feeling though, is there?
Yeah.
There's just no better feeling than that.
Well, the bad feeling is that you're sitting there and it's just getting darker and darker and darker by the minute. And the deer's there close, but he's got to move pretty quick or you're not going to get even lay eyes on him. And that's the bad thing about evening hunting is when the later it gets in the hunt, the closer it gets to dark, the better the deer movement is. And then when it peaks, it's too dark to see, and you got to slip out with all those deer around you. So, but close call, and I didn't want to shoot one the first night out anyway. I'd just soon get a few hunts in, have a little bit of a challenge there. So,
right. Yeah. So I don't know about you, but here in Kentucky, I believe it was Monday night, Tuesday, we got like 3.5 inches of rain, and then the temperature started dropping. Did you get the rain in front of the temperature drop or wind pickup, or did it miss you again?
We got 1/10.
Wow.
1/10 of an inch and missed it. Other than that, temperature did drop a good little bit. I mean, there was a couple of days where the high was only about 70, but it's worked back up. I bet it's pushing 80 today, and it's supposed to be 80, low 80s the next 2 days. And then another cold front. Well, I shouldn't even call it a cold front. It's supposed to cool off just a little bit starting Tuesday here. So
we only got up to 75, and I was wearing a hoodie this morning. I got up fairly early and took the maiden voyage of the new hunting trailer today to move some furniture for my mom. And it was a good test to just see if all the stuff that I had mounted on the wall and workbench and everything stayed on. And I'm proud to say everything stayed put. So I was thinking about another business opportunity. You know, there used to be a show called Trick My Truck where you decked out your truck for a certain purpose. I got the hunting trailer down. This is the third one or fourth one we've done. I know we got a lot of Amish people listening to you. I'm ready to take on tricking out an Amish buggy for deer hunting. We're going to have it all completely decked out, be able to have maybe a skinning pole on the back. I'm serious. I think I could make a business out of converting an Amish buggy into an ultimate deer hunting machine. What do you think?
Well, I think the big trick is going to be exchanging that horse up front for something with a motor on it for those long journeys. I mean, I don't know how far a horse can range from home, but a lot of my hunting trips are farther than I'd want to take a horse.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think any of our Amish friends would trust me with their buggy very long, especially when I'm highly allergic to horses. So I don't think that's going to be compatible. Let's talk a little bit about youth season this year. We're recording on the 11th, which is Saturday afternoon. We are both getting ready as soon as we get done to go to the woods. Are you planning on taking your grandson out for youth season tonight?
Yeah, as soon as we get off of here, I'm jumping in the shower, and he's supposed to be here about 4:30, so we can be in the blind by 5, and we'll see what happens. There's several, I call them shooter bucks, that I wish would walk out in front of him. We're going to be a little more selective than we have in the past. In the past, he was just looking for a buck. Well, we're not shooting yearlings anymore, and probably not shooting a 2-year-old either. We're going to shoot 3-year-olds and better. And there's plenty of them. So,
So what wind direction do you have there tonight, and what's the temperature going to be?
the temperature or the wind's northeast. So we're not going to get to hunt one of the better stands tonight, but it's switching to southeast tomorrow and Monday. So we'll get to hunt better stands on those days.
So are you going to, with a southeast, a wind out of the southeast, are you going, is that going to make it to where it's your first hunt in the Chasing Giants edition blind over the bridge crossing?
We could. Actually, there's one, two, three. Well, there's four different blinds that would work with a southeast wind, and I may just let him choose.
Yeah. I know tonight is going to be the first sit that I have in my Chasing Giants blind. It's youth season here also. I'm not taking anybody. I'm just going to throw a black hoodie and some orange over the top of me. I'm not even carrying a weapon, but tonight my goal is I have not been on the farm to glass all of the, you know how you can get up on top of your grain bin and see a lot of your. I do not have the clue about how many deer. I mean, I got trail cameras all over the place, but how many deer I'm really feeding. So, with EHD continuing to take its toll here in the state of Kentucky, I'm really curious about my deer numbers, to try to make some better decisions on doe harvest. Is this alfalfa? A lot of people mowed their hay last 2 weeks ago. So I'm really curious to see how many does I'm feeding and try to get a game plan for how many does to take here during rifle season.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to get better and better from here on out, and it's time to get a plan in place, and I'm trying to get a handle on how many does I want to shoot this year as well. They're getting the crops out around me. I mean, another week there's going to be almost nothing standing around me, and there's I'd say less than 25% of the crop is standing right now and coming out as we speak.
Well, real quick before we go to the Osseo break, I saw on social media that you were pulling corn samples to send off for tissue analysis. So this is something we do every year, but you and I personally are growing multiple varieties of corn on our home farms to compare it. And this is a challenge, and I don't want to go down a rabbit hole in it, but you can't just necessarily put two different corns right up against each other because they cross-pollinate. So we had to kind of strategically lay out our test plots to where they were independent of each other. But I saw a picture of you where you'd had the ears out and breaking everything out and putting it in Ziploc bags to send off. I have to pull those and bring those up to Dwayne in a couple weeks, excuse me. But I did do a test I've never done before. I got permission to hunt a property very close to my farm, and I'm not going to necessarily hunt it, but I did this test on the front of my tractor. I went and I shoveled standard ear corn from last year that we had in the corn crib. We're trying to get the corn crib cleaned out to where, we're getting ready to pick corn for this year. Filled the whole loader bucket up with standard field corn ear corn and went out and dumped it in a pile. And right beside that pile, I opened up bags of NutriTrave deer corn. And we had some extra NutriCrave blocks. And I threw like five blocks out. And then I dumped NutriCrave deer corn from our bags out over top of it. And I was just looking at the trail camera pictures this morning. That pile of ear corn is still completely there. And that NutriTrave deer corn is completely wiped out. And you can see the edges all eaten down of the NutriCrave block. So I'm really interested to see what these tissue analysis are going to show again. And this could be probably one of the best record growing seasons we've ever had.
Yeah. You know, I collected those samples, four different varieties of corn, and I think every one of them would have made over 200 bushel an acre. There's definitely some difference in the color in the ears. There was one in particular that does not look near as good as the other three in terms of the color, and I even made a comment on my post that I would bet money that that one has the worst analysis when the analysis comes back. And that deep, dark orange color it just kind of goes hand in hand with the better analysis. And the other three all have that to varying degrees. So it's going to be interesting. I started to film a segment for Chasing Giants TV, and I'm going to finish that whenever we get the analysis back. So be looking for that, and we'll see how it all turns out.
Yeah, speaking of Chasing Giants TV, we've released two hunt videos since we've been there, so make sure you're checking that out. And we have a couple videos this week. I think one of them might be, do you remember filming me putting fake eyes in my deer last year for the trophy pictures? Mm-hmm. I think that video posts this week on how to basically go to your taxidermist and get some glass eyes and make that deer really look great for your harvest pictures. Just some tips and tricks for that. So make sure you check out Chasing Giants TV. And but let's take a quick break and listen to a spot from our friends at Osseo, and we'll be right back.
Osseo gear was forged by apex predators. Our two camo patterns are built from nature's most lethal hunters and designed to vanish anywhere in the whitetail's range. Our raptor pattern draws inspiration from the unique feather patterns of a great horned owl, while our rapix pattern is derived from the patterns of bobcats, coyotes, mountain lions, and wolves. But camo's just the start. Every detail of our gear is engineered for bow hunters. From our patent-pending bow hunter and collar to our premium fabrics that keep you quiet, dry, and dialed in all seasons. Osseo gear is made to last, with our lifetime warranty standing behind every stitch. Visit Osseo gear and use code CHASINGGIANTS for 15% off your first order. That's asiogear.com.
Well, Don, in the second segment today, I want to touch on a topic that you actually... You didn't dive into it really deep, but you mentioned it on a podcast you were with another group this week. And I think it's just a fascinating topic about how your age, where you're sitting at right now, gave you maybe some perspective that not people older than you, say like the Wenzel brothers, or people younger than you and I, maybe even my age and younger. And I want you to just talk about it for a couple minutes, because I think it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah, you know, this time of the year, it seems like I get a lot of requests to be on other podcasts. And I did two other podcasts this week, and I got another one on Monday coming up. But I was being interviewed by Mark Kenyon, who has the Wired to Hunt podcast and also works with Meat Eater. And we were talking about technology and, you know, the effect it's had on deer hunting. And through that conversation, we just touched on this very briefly, but it got me to thinking that I've had people tell me that I grew up, or I hit the market, the hunting world at a sweet spot. I couldn't duplicate what I did today because there's just, you know, too many people involved, and they're talking about the consulting side of things. They're talking about starting up Real World and the success that both those things have had, and the timing was perfect. And as I thought about all those things, you know, I think they're right. I think my generation, I'm talking specifically guys my age, probably 5 years on either side of me, 5 years older, 5 years younger. I'm right at that sweet spot. So we grew up hunting without any technology. I remember when I shot my first 200 back in 2004, you know, at that point I already had over 20 years in the deer woods, and trail cameras were just coming out. I had one 35 millimeter trail camera at that time that, you know, it took the 35 millimeter film and you'd get 36 exposures, and you'd have to run it to the 1 hour processing to get it processed to see what was on your camera. And so the thing of it is, though, you know, I'd learned to deer hunt before that technology even existed. A lot of the technology today, not just trail cameras, but, you know, we can just go on the internet, for example, all the information that's readily available. I mean, back in the day, I had a subscription to North American Whitetail Magazine, Deer and Deer Hunting, and that was about the latest and the greatest and of modern technology as far as deer knowledge. Right. And today, a guy could get on the internet, and every day he could be reading new material or watching new videos. And I just grew up in that sweet spot where I learned to deer hunt and even hunt mature bucks before technology was there. And then technology came along, and I was still young enough to embrace that technology and utilize it, which I've been doing for 20 years. Guys older than me, you know, you mentioned the Wentzels and Bobby to some degree. And, you know, if I look even back further, Roger Rothar, that's what the topic was on that podcast I was being interviewed for. Those guys really, yeah, they can use that technology to some degree, but I don't think that generation has embraced it the way mine has. And then if I look the other direction at the guys younger than me, they really don't know about deer hunting without the technology and without the internet, without trail cameras. I remember when wildlife food plots was just unheard. Nobody planted anything for wildlife. The only thing wildlife ate was leftover crops in the field or whatever. Nobody was planting specifically for it. So I just think it really kind of struck me this week that I'm very blessed to grow up when I did, because I learned to hunt before the technology, but yet I was still old enough, or young enough rather, that I got in on the technology, which, you know, I've embraced. And you know, we could talk about drones and just go on the things that technology has brought to archery equipment. You know, I remember when I started, I'd say probably 50% of people were using recurves, and the other 50% were using the first compounds that came out. So, you know, I've seen a big change in the archery gear, but just, you know, everything that's went along with it. And it made me realize really how fortunate I am that I got in on both the old school woodsmanship type hunting, and then I got to take part in the technology side of things too.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating idea. I mean, I can't imagine when I first started hunting, there weren't trail cameras, and then you had, I don't think I ever had a 35 millimeter camera, but I remember before the 35 millimeter camera, you had the one that would pull the string. You stretch the string across the trail, and it would get a timestamp. I think they even had some with them without the string. You could see when stuff went by. But I remember the first time I spent a lot of money on something for deer hunting, like that. And it was this box that was bigger than like a shoebox you would get like a pair of work boots in. But it literally would hold a like Sony Handycam in it. And it would pick up and you could get video footage. Mm-hmm. And man, thought I was crazy spending that kind of money on something like that. And, but yeah, it's come a long way. I can't imagine today with you and I getting between 20 and 40,000 pictures a week across all of our pictures, relying on 35 or 36 pictures to go get them developed. We're in a different ballgame now, aren't we?
Without a doubt. You know, those cameras back then, they were called, the ones I had were called cam trackers. They were made down in Georgia. And the Cam Tracker company, it was the best camera at the moment. I mean, it was hands down the best at that time. And I remember those cameras costing like $600. And $600 back then would be about like $1,500 today. I mean, you didn't have a bunch of them. And that's back when I was working in a factory and, you know, scraping up pennies to make ends meet and such. But somehow I found the money to buy one of those. And then they took four C batteries and they took another battery. There was actually a 35 millimeter camera in that housing unit. It took a battery, and then the film, you had to buy the film, and then the cost to develop a 36 roll, and you know, you'd go through 36 pictures in one day. So always running out there to take and put new film in that camera, and well, we've come a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. I look back at it and think about the stuff that, and some of it's stupid, but just we're in a very, very blessed time that if people focus and learn the woodsmanship side of it and the old style with the technology today, it's I just wish the deer herd would have been what it was at certain other points too, but we won't go down that rabbit hole today. We're going to move everything up a little bit. We've gotten a lot of questions here lately. I think this time of year it sparked some more interest into submitting questions. So we're going to try to knock a few more out than normal today. So we're going to go ahead and move on with the 360 Blinds Higgins hot seat question. And before I ask you this question, I want to make a statement, because I don't want anybody taking this the wrong way, that both, I'm going to speak for you here for a second, buddy. Both you and I are never going to play a martyr or that, oh, woe is me, because we have figured out ways to build businesses in this industry. For that, we are very blessed and appreciative to everybody who supported us. But I had a conversation this week. We had a big open house at work and basically an internal trade show, and some guys were talking about, you know, if I was itching to go hunting, and I said, no, not really. I said, it, you know, when you hit it as hard as you and I do through middle October to Thanksgiving, we got our time coming. But they asked me a question, and I want your viewpoint on it, Don, and that is, when you take your hobby or your passion and you turn it into a career or a business, does it lose the appeal of the original hobby that you fell in love with? Because now there's, I wouldn't say pressure, but now there is basically your livelihood, your family's income, the businesses, the people that work for us. You know, there's a lot of things dependent on now what used to be just our hobby and our love to go out in God's creation and chase these giant bucks. What's your answer to that? Have you ever thought about that? Is it still as enjoyable as it was when you were a kid chasing it around, or not?
Well, the hunting part is every bit as enjoyable. The land management part is super enjoyable. The part that's not enjoyable is some of the people. You know, if I were to walk away from the hunting industry today, I would never walk away from deer hunting in the woods. And there's days where I've considered just becoming a hunter and deleting my social media accounts and just totally walking away from the whole public aspect of it and just being a deer hunter. So that I'd never lose interest in that. I'll tell you what really keeps me going, though, is the good people that we meet along the way. And, you know, every single week, I hear from somebody about what a difference we're making with this podcast in people's lives. And that encouragement, I don't think people understand the kind of hate that you and I talk about that we don't even talk about. We talk about a little bit, probably more than we should, but there is a whole lot that we never talk about. And I'm not going to talk about it now, but the fact that others will take time to encourage us, I just can't say how much that means, because that's what keeps us driven, knowing that, yeah, we're catching it, you know, from this side, but this other side is, you know, recognizing that we're trying to do good for people. And but some days, you know, that when I do decide to to hang it up. I'm not hanging up my bow, so to speak. I'll still be a hunter. But the whole public side of it, some days that gets old. And I don't think people really understand. I would never encourage one of my grandsons to do what I'm doing. Never. You better be pretty darn thick-skinned and if you want to do this.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think we've both encouraged and supported our friends who want to start businesses in this industry. Starting a business in this industry is different than being in necessarily the public eye, I think is what you're saying.
Yep.
And I think there's even a question about that later tonight on the show about one of our friends that started a business. But I fully believe, and trust me, I've come from the corporate world. I've dabbled in this, and I also own my own business now. And everybody, if you can turn your passion and your love into a business, something that you enjoy doing every day, and especially if you can do it to where you can make a difference in someone else's life and be an example and show the Christian values, and man, go for it. I'm all for the side hustle that may one day turn into your career. I think it's made such a blessing in our life. I know it has your too.
Yep, absolutely. It has. And I just, you know, it was all about timing. Yeah, very fortunate. There was a lot of years of struggling, and you know, people think that they see me today, especially younger guys that didn't know me back when I was first starting as an outdoor writer and such. And they think, well, Don's got this big manicured farm and he's got all this money and he can all this equipment to plant his food plots and this and that. And they never seen the struggle. And I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. I wouldn't want to be born with a silver spoon. I want to work and achieve everything that I get. I think that's really the only way you appreciate it. And I've had a lot of doors open. And when they did open though, I ran through them. I didn't stand there and try to peek through the crack and see what was on the other side. I kicked the door off its hinges and I ran through the other side and grabbed it. But you know, God opened a lot of doors for me.
You know, I've heard Lee Lukoski say the exact same thing. You know, they've told the stories about getting their electric shut off and, on different shows. So, I think people take for granted how much work goes into it, but boy, we sure appreciate our friends that we can celebrate and we can kind of pay it forward. You know, how many people that just because of our show that we can mention and help support their businesses, the fact that we have a platform that we can make a difference with other people's livelihoods and families, it means a lot. So appreciate your all's support for that. Let's take a quick break for the Midwest Land Group segment and our listener submitted questions. We're going to try to knock out a few more here this week. We'll be right back.
Does your real estate agent know the difference between a rub and a scrape, or did they ask how many deer you caught this year? At Midwest Land Group, our agents evaluate the land the way serious hunters do, because it's exactly who we are. From surveys, soil types, floodplains and easements, to timber quality, tree stands, access, and food plots. Whether you're interested in buying or selling, work with an agent who speaks your language. Visit MidwestLandGroup.com to connect with one today. Midwest Land Group. Buyers, sellers, land. Connected.
All right, our first question comes from Greg Schroeder from Waconia, Minnesota. It says, "Hey Don, I haven't heard you talk about the mailman Steven lately. As a fellow brother in blue, I'm wondering if he is still delivering your mail flawlessly. Thanks for all you guys do. P.S. Shout out to Emerson Day. I love her music." Steven the mailman is no longer hauling my mail. He hasn't for probably a year now, I'm guessing. Actually, we kind of got him started on a new business. He is now in the fencing business. And, I think we're keeping him hopping. I did talk to him here fairly recently, and I told him, I said, "Hey, I need some more brochures. Get me some brochures so I can throw them in those plans we do for our consulting clients this winter." But he's no longer our mailman. Did a great job. Definitely miss him. And he's doing fantastic in his new venture.
He told me he is more busy. He's busier than he wants to be. So that's a great problem to have as a small business owner. What that means for small business owners is you can start being more selective about the jobs that you want to do versus getting your business established where you have to do everything just to generate cash flow and keep busy. So that's the tipping point on a small business. Austin Razor's found it. I think Jay Gringrich has found it. You get to the point where your business is busy enough that you can start picking and choosing, you know, how far you want to travel or what type of work you want to do. So Steven's a great guy. I also talked to him not too long ago. So yeah. Speaking of friends, before, while I'm getting the next question up on the screen, talk about two of our buddies that have shot great deer. We forgot to mention one a couple of weeks ago, but then we had another friend that shot one here this week.
Yeah, Aaron Gaines shot just a fantastic Missouri buck close to his home. But, you know, Aaron's got this thing figured out. He killed did he kill a 200-incher? I think he did,
yeah.
Didn't he, a year or two ago. But, yeah, I actually am going to speak at Aaron's church next March. So Shelbina, Missouri is where it's at. I'll be out there in March to speak, and you'll hear more about that on here. But, yeah, Aaron killed a fantastic buck. And then this week, Derek Burkholder shot the biggest buck on their farm. And the story is fantastic. They actually got it on video even. So I'm hoping that we can share that video through Chasing Giants TV. So I don't want to spoil it too much here. But Derek said that this buck was just played the plan to a T, just followed the plan to the letter. The way the property was set up. And, you know, I've consulted for Derek's dad, Eddie Ray, several years ago, and Derek was a bit younger then and had a lot of interest and kind of took him under my wing back in the day. And now he's a consultant working with us, and he's got it figured out too. He knows how to set a farm up. You know what was interesting about that is his buck was bedded, consistently bedding in switchgrass on that farm. This week when I was hunting, the two biggest bucks I seen this week, the 2 3-year-olds, they both came out of switchgrass in the evening. They'd been bedded in there. It just blows me away to get on the internet and hear people say or read their comments that deer don't like to bed in switchgrass. I'm telling you what, not on my farm and not on my clients' farms, and obviously not on Derek's farm, but you know, hopefully you can throw some pictures up here, Terry, of both Derek and Aaron's bucks. And yep. Proud to be associated with both those guys.
Yeah, if you're listening on audio platforms, you'll probably want to go somewhere around the 33 to 36-minute mark, I would guess. I don't know because we haven't edited the podcast yet and put the commercials in, but if you want to see pictures of those bucks, switch over to YouTube, and we'll put them both of those up with Aaron and Derek. Yeah, super happy for those guys. And, you know, yeah, if Derek's Amish, so some of the pictures, obviously, you know, in the video, we'll be respectful of his wishes with that. But yeah, if he lets us use that and tell the story of the buck, which I think is what's important, I think it'll be awesome. So hope to bring more of that to everybody soon.
Okay. Next question comes from Jason Fry from Xenia, Illinois. Says, on the podcast, you've talked about leveling up your harvest by consistently harvesting 160-inch bucks age class before moving on to the next age class, etc. What exactly does consistently mean in that context? Does it mean every year or something else, especially in years where you may not have a buck that meets that standard to chase? I listened to your advice of same time, same place theory, and it aided me in harvesting my first 160-inch plus 10-point. I had 4 years of data on this buck, and I named him Herman after Herman Munster from the old TV show. Also, I have a genetic eye condition that isn't correctable along with being red-green colorblind. What are some effective ways to determine the age class of bucks, either from the stand or trail camera photos with limited vision? Sometimes I find it difficult to tell which deer is which while in the stand. I've tried using binoculars, but I feel like they create too much movement and risk spooking the deer. On episode 292, you discussed a time you shot a deer that you thought was an older age class, but turned out he was a younger buck. This resonated with me as this happened to me. Thanks to you, Terry, and the entire team for all that you do. Well, consistently killing deer, killing a buck of a certain age class, you know, I don't think it's my place to tell people, you know, when to raise the bar, but I can tell you what I did when I got to the point where I could kill a particular size is what I was after then more than age, you know, like for a period of time, it was 140 inch bucks. And, you know, that was my goal every year was 140 inch or better. And when I got to the point where I could do that 4 out of 5 years, then it was time to raise the bar. And usually I was not raising the bar after a year I did not kill 140 inch deer. I'd raise the bar after I'd killed like 2 years in a row or so. And I wasn't necessarily stuck at one, you know, level for 5 years. Sometimes it might've been longer, before I would raise the bar. So consistency to me means, you know, at least 80% of the time, 4 out of 5 years, you're killing your target buck. And you got to remember, and you bring it up, that the higher you raise that bar, the more difficult it's going to be to find that buck because there's so many fewer of them. You want to shoot 170 inch deer, you're going to be putting some effort into it to find 170 inch deer every year. So you got to take that into consideration too, because you don't want to get to the point where you're never shooting anything. I mean, I think if you're not shooting a buck at least once out of every 3 years, then you probably need to lower your standards just a little bit. And that can change with the individual hunter as well. I mean, some people, it may not bother them to kill a buck every 5 or 10 years or whatever. That's not going to cut it with me. I know if I was only killing a buck every 5 years, I'd be putting some more effort into finding the bucks I want to shoot.
Or relocating to a different spot to meet that goal.
Exactly. Yeah. Move to somewhere else. And so, you know, consistently killing a certain class of deer, I'm just going to leave that to the listener. I don't want to be trying to push my level or beliefs or whatever on everybody that's listening to this, but that's just what I did, and it worked good for me to get to where I'm at today. And I think if you try to make the jumps too quick, it's going to just lead to frustration, and too many seasons of not tagging deer can make you give up the sport even. I don't want to see anyone do that. So,
right.
Second part of the question was about recognizing specific deer from a stand. You've got some kind of you know, vision issues, which I do not have. And to be honest, today, I see a buck coming, and quickly I can recognize which buck it is from trail camera pictures. I don't have to, you know, sit there and study them or anything. It becomes pretty obvious. You mentioned one time I shot a buck that was the wrong buck. Yeah, I did. That was probably 25 to 30 years ago. And I'll tell you this, I never did it again. There's no better way to break yourself of that habit than to wrap your tag around it and be done hunting for the year, which is exactly what happened in that case. And when it's, you know, November and you're sitting out the rest of the season, you miss the entire late season, you miss half the rut because you shot the wrong buck. I mean, it's one thing if you shoot the buck you're really after. Yeah, that's a happy way to end the season. But you shoot the wrong buck and that ends your season. You don't do that twice, or at least I don't. To be honest, I think a lot of it is the heat of the moment. You know, here comes a buck, and you're sitting there and you want to shoot. Every one of us is sitting there. We want to shoot a deer while we're sitting there. We want to shoot a buck. And sometimes the excitement just tells us to go ahead and shoot when maybe deep down we know we probably shouldn't have. And I'm not saying that was the case with me. I think it just, in my situation, a bigger buck had come by just previous, and this buck came from the direction the other buck left, and I thought it was the same deer, and just quickly drew back and shot while the deer was coming out of the brush. And I had no excuse. I'll never do that again. So,
well, we don't have eye conditions, but I can tell you that you spend a lot of time studying pictures. And I don't think people understand you spend a lot of time out in the field, but you spend a lot of time studying pictures. And I remember last year when you were videoing for me on the west side of the sanctuary, we were up in a tree together, and I looked up and I could see a deer coming up out of the brush, out of the sanctuary, and said, big buck coming. And you got back in your tree and you couldn't see it because of a tree. But as soon as it stepped out, even way down in the cover, you were like, not a shooter, not a shooter. This is not a shooter.
We can show that footage too.
Yeah.
Actually, we just did on Chasing Giants TV. We just showed that footage on my target buck.
That was footage after he came up and was underneath of us for a while.
Yep, same buck though.
Yep, same buck, and that was one of the ones we were going to pass. But I mean, it wasn't. You didn't have to. My point was, you didn't have to study the deer for 25 seconds to see. You knew enough about the characteristics of that deer. As soon as you saw him, you were like, "Nope, put your bow down, boy. This isn't going to happen." Yeah.
That deer had pretty good brow tines, and so I recognized those brows pretty quick and knew which deer it was.
But, you know, studying, you know, obviously it doesn't take the eye condition into play for our listener. But, yeah, you spend a lot of time studying pictures, and I know when I'm hunting on your farm, you know, that's just you have to understand what you're shooting at, because the last thing you want to do is be given the liberty to hunt your farm and then shoot the wrong buck. That's for sure. So, what about aging deer? Are you going to fall into that trap of, is it a 3-year-old or 4-year-old by some appearances? Because we've been fooled on that before too.
Yeah. We actually got a video out on the Chasing Giants TV channel, about aging deer, and it's been out for probably 3 or 4 years now, but I made it very clear that I don't believe you can look at a deer and age it by a photo or even seeing it. Now, yeah, you can tell year-and-a-half-old bucks, and most of the time you can tell 2-year-olds, but once they reach 3, it becomes very difficult. I also think you can tell an old, mature buck, but can you tell if he's 5 or if he's 8? No, you can't.
Remember that 9-pointer I shot out of the ladder stand that time on your place?
Yep,
I did. It was a 9-pointer with real short brows, and Don's like, "You got to crack this 3-year-old." And I went ahead and sent his teeth off. And I can't remember, was he a 6 or 7-year-old? I can't remember, but I mean, he had us fooled. Mm-hmm. I believe he's a 6-year-old.
Yeah, I don't remember. I remember the buck, but I don't remember what his age was. But You just can't, unless you watch the deer grow up. If you hear us talk about a deer's age, it's because we've watched him, you know, since he was a yearling or 2-year-old.
Yep, absolutely. All right, here's the third question.
This one comes from Jason Hesselberg from Manchester, Michigan. It says, "Don and Terry, I'm getting my property logged right now. They were supposed to start in August and have it done in 2 to 3 weeks, which didn't happen. They started later than expected. Then their equipment broke a few times, so currently they are still logging, which hopefully will be done soon. My question is about my bucks coming back. I had 3 mature bucks made it last year, and they usually showed up on my farm in mid to late September. Of course, with all the logging being done, I have not had any pictures of them yet. Once the logging is done, will they still come back to my property, or will they relocate somewhere else for this year or even for good?" Well, from my experience, a mature buck very rarely relocates. Now, he may start utilizing a different part of his range more than he did previously, but just to pick up and move on to someplace he's never been before, that rarely happens. I know sometimes you hear stories about a buck that disappears for a year and then he shows back up, but I still say that deer did not leave his home range. He just was utilizing a different part of his home range, and that's what I'm going to guess your bucks are probably doing right now with the disturbance on the property. They're still within the same home range that they had a year ago, but they're in a different part of that home range. And I think that logging you're going to find is going to be very beneficial. It's going to make your property better than it was before. whether those bucks come back this year, get killed somewhere else or what, it's hard to say, but I would guess that they're going to come back at some point if they're still alive.
I think when people talk about logging in TSI or switchgrass and miscanthus, you got to understand you're playing a long-term game. I mean, yeah, we want to kill that mature buck that's a shooter on this year or next year. But this is something that's going to play pivotal roles if done correctly for years to come on your property. And you got to focus on the long-term benefit versus the short-term thing.
Absolutely. The next one comes from Jeff Schweiger from Casco, Michigan. It says, follow-up question to my recently submitted. Can miscanthus be used as a windbreak to block snow, or is it easily laid down by wind, snow, and ice? My miscanthus is near a tree line, so not a good representation of what it could do to block wind and snow. Will snow drift along a row of miscanthus? Thanks again for your great podcast. Absolutely, Jeff. In fact, miscanthus has got a stalk like bamboo. I think that's the only thing you can compare it to. And I have never seen wind totally knock down miscanthus. And I've got miscanthus along a couple of property borders, and I can tell you that the snow just blows and drifts against that miscanthus. If you've got a long drive and you could plant miscanthus there and probably stop snow from drifting on your drive. Knowing my luck, the wind would blow the other way and it'd pile it up onto my drive 6 foot deep or something. But yeah, absolutely. It'll stop that. We got another question recently about, will it serve as a sound barrier? And I think it will to some degree. I mean, probably nothing major, but to some degree it probably would. There's actually a spot along Interstate 57 near Champaign, Illinois, where they've planted a strip of miscanthus. It's not real long. I'm going to say maybe 200 yards long. And I'm guessing it was done through the University of Illinois, because the University of Illinois has a miscanthus program. They've got some test plots and such there that we've been to and visited. But I think they did that to test about snow drifting across the interstate. And it absolutely will stop drifting snow.
Interesting. All right. I'm burning through these pretty quick, trying to get through them all.
The next one comes from Brett Falk from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. It says, Don and Terry, thank you for all you do to advance the kingdom of God in all your endeavors. My question relates to shooting does with buck fawns to keep those fawns from leaving a property, enhancing the likelihood of them making their birth area a core area for them as they grow into mature bucks. If dispersal of buck fawns is nature's way of preventing inbreeding, isn't killing the doe to keep those buck fawns from doing as nature intends counterintuitive? In other words, is keeping those buck fawns in their birth territory resulting in them breeding offspring from the same mother as theirs when they reach breeding status, which is opposite of the way nature intends for it to work? If so, what damage can this do over time to a herd? Well, I think that's a great question and great observation by Brett, but I think that it's going to happen so infrequently that it's not really consequential to the local deer herd. I actually remember, I think it was Dr. James Kroll, Dr. Deer, one time, he had a theory that some of these giant bucks that are out in the wild, that they are the result of some inbreeding or line breeding, depending on how you want to look at it. And his theory was that a lot of the big deer in captivity are a result of line breeding. So line breeding is when you're breeding a male to a related female. You don't want to do it too close. And it's done in all forms of animal breeding. They do it in dogs. They do it in horses. They do it in cattle. They do it in the captive deer side of things. And what it does is a lot of times it accentuates the traits in that animal. So let's say a certain bloodline is basically known for a certain desirable trait, whatever that may be. Well, by breeding those two related animals, you can really accentuate that trait and make it even more dominant. The bad thing is it can also accentuate bad traits or bad genes. So there's kind of a joke in the animal breeding world that if it works, it's line breeding, and if it doesn't work, it's inbreeding. But it's really the same thing. And again, you don't do it too close. Usually, you know, like in livestock, you're like breeding a male to his granddaughter or something like that. It's never like, you know, father to daughter or brother to sister. It's separated a little bit farther than that. But so Dr. Kroll's theory was that when that happens in the wild, a lot of times it will result in a giant buck. And I hope I'm giving credit to the right person. I don't like taking credit for something that I didn't come up with. And if I remember right, it was Dr. Kroll. If not, I apologize to him and to the person who I did not give credit to. But that was a reasonable theory in my way of thinking, that, you know, maybe a buck remains in his birth area and he breeds, you know, who knows, a half sister. Maybe the next year his mother got bred by a different buck. So he's got half sisters and he breeds them. But I mean, that's the thing. The same doe is typically not going to get bred to the same buck year after year after year. So you're not going to have that close inbreeding, or it's very, very rare that you're going to have that close inbreeding. So I don't think it's something to worry about. And besides that, you know, nature, if left on her own, there's going to be females, does, get killed, whether it's by whatever, by predators. And thus, when that happens, she's going to be leaving her male offspring probably to live out their life in their birth area. So it doesn't matter if it's hunters doing this intentionally as a way to keep more buck fawns on their property, or it's gonna happen anyway.
Well, there's another stat out there that I think also plays a pivotal role in this, and that is, and man, we're having trouble remember citing who said it tonight, and maybe it was Dr. Strickland who explained that a very high percentage of time, twins inside of a doe have different sires. So that means when that doe is ovulating, she's being bred by more than one buck. And it's a very high likelihood that twins have different fathers. So the likelihood of, let's say you killed a mother and a brother and a sister having the exact same mother and father having a baby is like playing the lottery. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And I think what maternal aggression is really in all species from what, cause when we heard that, I pulled him aside and we had a separate conversation. What maternal aggression is for is to keep the offspring from breeding the mother. So like if a doe had a son, to keep that son from breeding her, because the likelihood that you could have a boy and a girl have the same mother and father in the deer herd, to have that specific of level of inbreeding, I think is impossible. I shouldn't say what it was. Strickland say, don't never say always, never say never.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
Brett Falk, the listener submitted this question. He's actually a consultant client of ours, really good friend of ours and customer of Austin Razor's company. Super, super great guys. And they have an unbelievable farm. We did a plan for that and it has turned out phenomenal. So happy for those guys. They've put a lot of time, money and effort into that property, but super great guys. Thanks for submitting that question for us, Brett.
Next question comes from Rob Eshman from Sterling Heights, Michigan. Boy, the Michigan boys were putting out the questions this week. He says, hi, Don and Terry. My question to you both is, how do I store my leftover seed from this past planting season? I have some partial bags of Real World Clover seed, Gen 2 soybeans, and Deadly Dozen seed. Should I keep the seed in a storage bin container stored in a cool temperature moisture control environment until I can use the seed for the next planting season. Thank you both for all you do and sharing your advice for deer hunting and keeping the faith in our Lord and Savior. Well, Rob, you hit the nail on the head. That's a question we get quite a bit, and that's why I wanted to use this to throw it out to everyone. Is a lot of seed can be carried over year to year with very little germination loss as long as it's stored properly. So the question is, what is properly? Well, it's free of three things, starting with M, moisture, mice, and I forget what the other one was. I've heard Dwayne say this, but moisture, mice, it must be something to do with temperature. But anyway, you don't want it to freeze. You don't want it to dry out. So you want some moisture. The ideal way to store it is in a plastic tote of some kind in your basement. There's typically enough, it's damp enough in a basement that there's going to be enough moisture to hold that germ. And that plastic tote will keep it away from the mice. So if you do that, your seed's going to lose very little germ from year to year. One exception can be soybeans. Soybeans is probably one of the more volatile seeds that we sell. And even at that, you know, it's not going to lose like 50% germ unless it's just, you know, stored outside or something or in a shed where critters are getting in it and everything else. It might lose 20% in a year. But then you still got, you know, 75% germination. So, you know, just store it away from the mice in a cool, damp place, but not freezing.
Yep. All right. Last question of the night.
This one comes from Mark Jackson from Greenwood, Indiana. It says, guys, please spend a little time reviewing how to properly calculate seed quantities and slippage calculations. It never fails that I don't order enough seed. How big of a factor is the planter and its settings? I love the Genesis drill I purchased from Don this year. My results have improved immensely, but I still ran short on seed. Thanks for all your guidance, Mark. Mark's another consulting client with a good property in Indiana, so good to hear from him. You know, the calibration, we put a calibration sticker on the drills that we sell, and that calibration sticker covers the real-world products. But here's the thing. Those drills are, each one can be off just a little bit. And those charts that we put on there are basically starting points. And it's a good idea to start there and then test your drill to make sure that calibration is where you want it to be. And if not, make a note on that sticker with a Sharpie or something so that you know next time. And again, those are only starting points. I always have a little extra seed instead of running out of seed. I don't try to, you know, if I got a 3-acre soybean plot that I'm trying to plant, I don't buy 3 bags of soybeans, a bag per acre. I'll buy 4. And most things you're fine putting a little extra seed out. There's a couple of exceptions, you know, the brassicas, the turnips, radish, that kind of thing. Switchgrass, you don't want to go over. Corn, you want to be pretty consistent. But, you know, clover, soybeans, some of those other things, cereal grains, you can overseed, you know, more than the recommended rate and still get a great crop. So just calibrate your drill specifically and don't depend on somebody else's numbers to come out exactly right with your drill.
Yep, absolutely. Well, thanks for all the questions. I'm glad we got a couple extras done to catch up. Submit your questions at chasinggiants.com. That's going to take you to the Higgins Outdoors page where you'll find our podcast page intermingled with all of the consulting services and other things that we offer. So, but if you want to submit a question, go to chasinggiants.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and fill out that form, and we'll get it in queue for a future episode. Brent Henderson, we talked about him a couple weeks ago having open heart surgery. He is going absolutely stir crazy So I think he put a little extra time in. He even edited the Sunday night prayer time for me. So I don't even have to do that because I think he's going a little stir crazy at home, but recovering well. Keep him in your prayers. But also, before Don closes this out, a special request for I don't even call him a friend. I consider him and his wife family, but Dwayne Hopkins lost his dad this week and was laid to rest. And man, Dwayne is just a special, special person to a lot of people around the Real World and Green Prairie family. And just heartbreaks for him, but knowing he's going to see his dad in heaven is something to celebrate. So please be keep praying for the Hopkins family as Dwayne lost his dad. But yeah, Brent Henderson will have the Sunday night prayer time this week. And I hope that you're making a post on Facebook here in a few hours that Walker got him a buck. What do you think?
Well, we're going to give it a shot. We'll see what happens. And we'll have something to talk about next week on the podcast if he does. Maybe even get him on here. I doubt it. He's kind of a little bit shy, so probably won't get him to say much. But, you know, before I close out, I also want to send prayers out to the family of Jason Beachy in Ohio. I just received word a couple days ago that he lost his battle with cancer this week and owned and operated JB's Feed there. I spoke there back in June, actually, and Jason at that time didn't even know that he had cancer, so it hit him fast and hard. And definitely a great guy, and want to just send out prayers for his family and know he's going to be missed. I know we're going to miss him. He's been to every dealer event we've had. Just a fantastic human being. So prayers to that family as well. Just God bless everyone. We'll see you back here next week.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.
Hey guys, this is Brent Henderson, and I just want to say it's an honor and a privilege and a blessing to be back with you guys this week. Because unless you don't know my story, I shouldn't be here today. And I'm not talking about, like, because of scheduling, I'm talking about I really shouldn't be here. Some stuff happened in my life about 5.5 weeks ago that really was a miracle. And I just kind of want to tell you a little bit about it, because one of the things that I really want to drive home is that the enemy loves to create fear in our lives. Because if he can create fear, then he can kind of hold us hostage. You know, we think about, like, past and future thinking. You know, the past really kind of holds us in shame, you know, shoulda, woulda, couldas, right? But future thinking, you know, what if I lose my house? What if I lose my car? What if my wife leaves me? What if my daughter gets pregnant? What if I have to have open heart surgery? Ding, 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 we have a winner. That's the one that hit me about 5.5 weeks ago. I was getting ready for an elk hunt in Colorado at 10,000 feet, going to be out there hunting with my buddy Roger Medley. This is a bow hunt. We've had some incredible adventures before. Had some really dangerous things happen in past years. And I thought, you know, this year I'm going to be better prepared. You know, I wasn't just training 90 days before the hunt. I mean, I was training for this thing, I mean, for the last year. You know, I'm sitting here in my studio, but I also have attached, I've got like my treadmill and my bike, and I've got, you know, free weights and cable machines and all that stuff. And I was really, really training hard, putting the backpack on my back, putting extra weight in it, you know, using the push mower, mowing probably more than I should have because I wanted to get the cardio in. And it was about 6 weeks ago, I was going to bed one evening and I had kind of mowed late and I was having a little bit of pain in my chest. And I just kind of blew it off because I'd had it before, but I just thought it was like some kind of an asthma deal. My general practitioner thought it was the same thing. He said, Brent, he goes, you stay in incredible shape all the time. He said, I wish all my other like 64-year-old patients, you know, would pay attention to their health like that. So I went upstairs, got a shower, but the pain just kind of didn't subside. And I'm thinking, yeah, this probably isn't good. I went ahead, crawled into bed, and I thought, you know what, I'm not going to tell my wife because it's going to go away. You know, that's what we do as men, right? We have something, it'll get better. It didn't. And it lasted for about an hour. I thought, man, I don't want to go to the emergency room this late at night and drag my wife out of here and go through something for, you know, and the expense. And all they're going to say is, yeah, you just had some kind of like gas. Here, take some Tums. I had a doctor's appointment coming up. This was a Friday. I had it coming up on a Monday. And I went to my doctor and I said, hey, I've got my hunt coming up. I just want to make sure everything's good to go. And he says, well, you're looking strong. You're healthy. And he said, any other problems? He says, no. I said, I honestly feel great. But, and then I told him a little bit about the chest pain. And he asked me how long this had been going on. And I said, probably longer than I want to admit. I said, it's kind of been happening all summer off and on when I'll mow. I said, I'll be mowing and I'll get 10 minutes into mowing with the push mower and I'll start to feel this tightness going across my chest and I'll kind of stop for about 30 seconds and then I'm fine. I can go right back and mow the rest of the yard. I said, the same thing happens when I'll get on my treadmill. I'll get about, you know, 10 minutes into it. I'll start making the incline going higher and higher and then I'll start to feel a little bit of pressure. I'll back the incline down, slow down a little bit for about a minute and then I'm good. I can go the next 3.5-4 miles strong. And he said, you know, why don't we just go ahead and get a chest x-ray on you? He said, why don't we just go ahead and let's get what's called a calcium score done on you. So he had me go to the hospital and they did a heart scan. Now, your calcium score, when it comes back, you know, this is the calcified plaque that you have that's in the arteries in your heart. It needs to be 400 or less. That's the average number. And when I got my number back that afternoon, I thought this has to be a typo. I didn't know a number could look like this. My number was 4,410. And I was just totally like, what do I do with this? I mean, something can't be right. So my wife works at the hospital and she went she works in pulmonary. She went to the cardiac area next to her. And she told the main cardiologist about what this was. He goes, let's go ahead and get him in tomorrow. So they got me, and he looked at my scores, and he says, yeah, he said, unfortunately, this isn't because of diet. It's not because you don't take care of yourself. It's a genetic issue. He said, you're probably fine to go on your elk hunt in a couple weeks because this didn't happen overnight. I mean, you had this number for decades. This is a genetic issue. And he explained to me, you know, how the arteries are kind of elastic, and when you're younger, they can move around a lot. But the older you get, the stiffer they get. And when that plaque gets calcified, it begins to close off those arteries that are going to your heart. As he's telling me this stuff and he's drawing me a diagram, I'm realizing this score wasn't a typo. He's telling me you have an issue here. But at the moment, he says, you know what, let's go ahead and get a heart scan done for you, like some other testing done tomorrow. He says, I think you're still going to be good because you've lived with this for years. So I go in, they inject me with this dye, and I go through all the heart scans, and then they said, you know what, tomorrow we're going to do a stress test on you. So I show up for the stress test, and I get on the treadmill, and they put all these things all over me, and I'm thinking, I'm just going to kill this. I'm going to show them what I can do. You know, I've been training hard, and, you know, I was kind of proud, you know, prideful being 64, almost 65, and really being in good shape. And he begins to push me, and I think the incline goes up to like 17 on this treadmill, and he put me up there, and he's just going, and I'm talking, right? I'm still talking. I'm not like huffing and puffing. I'm not breaking out into a sweat. He says, wow. He says, I've pushed you really hard. He said, just have a seat there for a minute, and he kept watching the numbers on the screen. But my blood pressure and heart rate wasn't coming down in the time period that it needed to be able to do that and what should have been doing it. So he gets on the phone, he calls the cardiologist, and he says, you know what, we're going to have a heart cath done on him. Get him scheduled for tomorrow morning. And I'm going, really? And I'm not thinking about, you know, a possible, you know, heart issue, heart attack. I'm thinking, I'm not going to be able to go on this elk hunt. You know, my priorities were there. So I go in the next day, and they bring me in, and they have to do all this stuff. They have to shave you and get you all ready for this heart cath. And, you know, they're shaving my wrist, and then they're like, no, we got to shave you everywhere in case we have to do this cath up through your groin. I'm going, oh, this is not a whole lot of fun. My buddies are just going to have a whole lot of fun teasing me about this. So finally, they get me done. They wheel me in, and I don't even remember most of it. I thought I was awake, but evidently, you know, they kind of get you some kind of a solution that kind of half knocks you out. But as they're bringing me out of this, I can remember the cardiologist looking at me. He takes off his gloves, and the first thing that he says, looking down at me, still on the table, He says, unfortunately, and I said, I don't like that word. He says, yeah. He says, unfortunately, we can't do stents on you. He said, we'd have to do at least 11 stents. And he says, we can't do that. He says, so unfortunately, I'm sorry to tell you, you're going to have open heart surgery. He said, honestly, I don't even know how you walked in here. He said, we usually only find this kind of blockage in autopsies. Those were his words. Yeah, great bedside manner, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm in shock. I mean, I'm totally in shock. So they wheel me back behind this curtain and they shut it, and I'm waiting for my wife to come back, and I'm just wrestling with all this. And as she comes in, you know, because I was only back there for 45 minutes to an hour, and she's thinking, hey, I'm out. Everything must have gone great. And she comes in and she looks at me, and I can't talk to her. She says, well, I didn't know what to do. You know how you can do this? And I just kind of like, when it's not a good thing, I just looked at her and I just took my hand and I went down the center of my chest, meaning they're going to have to break me open and do open heart surgery. And she just looks at me and she's like, you're kidding, right? And she sees me begin to tear up and I can't talk. And the tears begin to pour down her face. You know, what do you do in those moments when the rug has just been pulled out from underneath you? I mean, this was fast. I thought I was in the best shape of my life at 64. You know, a year ago, I was in this like Mr. Muscle and Fitness competition thing that I got into because kind of a fluke. And I ended up, you know, being in the top 1% of all the guys in the nation that got into this. And I'm thinking, this can't be right. This can't be happening. I get home, you know, and I'm realizing, he says, I want you to go home. You can't lift. You can't mow. You can't do anything. He says, this is really life and death. We're getting you in for emergency surgery in just a couple of days. Go home and do nothing. And I get home and I go upstairs by myself. And I literally collapse on this ottoman that we have right in front of the couch. And I go face down, and I remember saying this three times, God, I don't want this, I don't want this, I don't want this. And for the next 30 minutes, it was a combination of just crying out to God, crying, and just every prayer that I could think of, because I wanted to control the issue. I didn't want this. This can't be real. And I can't even begin to tell you, by the time I got to the end of those 30 minutes, something changed. That faith and that trust that has been in me my whole life began to bubble to the surface. And I can remember the very end of my prayer. It was like I had been watching The Chosen not long before that, and where Jesus is praying in the garden, you know, the Father, if this cup can pass from me. And I began to say that out loud. There's something that when you are tested and you are tried, that if you have the Word of God in you, it begins to come up and it begins to fill you. And I said, Father, I want this to pass from me, but I don't want my will. I want yours. If there's something that you need me to see. And it wasn't just that there was something he wanted me to see. He was going to heal my body because my heart was in bad shape. We found out, you know, I had to have quadruple bypass surgery only a couple of days later. You know, they took an artery, runs from my wrist up to my elbow. They took one out of my chest. They took one out of my leg from below my knee up to my groin area. And they were using all these things to rebuild my heart. But God wasn't just going to heal my heart physically. He was going to heal me from some things that I had no clue I even needed healing from. And the process began. I remember, this is really cool. The next morning, we're driving down for surgery. It's 5:30 in the morning. It was foggy out. My head had been in a fog for the last few days. And as we got within a couple of miles of the hospital, all of a sudden, it's like that fog lifted. And that fear that had been haunting me, the enemy just whispering in my ear, Brent, what if this is it? You know, what if you die in surgery because they have to stop your heart and restart it? And it's a 6.5-hour surgery. It was all those what ifs. That's future thinking. That's what fear is. The enemy makes you go into the future to think about those things. And God reminded me, no, stay in the present with me. I have this. And I felt this incredible peace like I had the night before when I was praying. And so they get me in the hospital. They get me, you know, the gown on. They're all ready to take me back. They're already giving me some things to begin to numb parts of me. And There were two things that went through my mind as they were wheeling me back. One was something my mother used to always say to me. She'd say, "Honey, remember, this too shall pass." And the second thing was from a movie, Tombstone. Maybe some of you guys have seen this. You've got Doc Holliday in there, and he's about to get into a gunfight. And you would think in that moment he would show fear and he'd be sweating, but he doesn't shake. He doesn't show any fear at all. He just kind of taps the top of his pistol on the handle, on the grip, and he looks at the enemy square in the face, and he says, "Say when." If you guys listen to my Unleashed podcast at all, you've heard me do that at the very beginning. I'll start off the podcast with, "Say when." Because what he was relaying was, "I'm not afraid of you. Go ahead, take your best shot." Because I knew as they were wheeling me in, something that a buddy of mine who was a police officer had said to me before the surgery. He said, "Brent, I've been an officer for 35 years. I never knew every single day whether I was going to be coming home to my family or not." He said, "So I had to trust God. And this is what I always remembered, that until God calls me home, I am invincible." And I just remember them wheeling me in, and I just looked at the enemy and I said, "Say when." You know, I came out of surgery after about 6.5 hours. I know it was terribly hard for my wife. You know, the fear and everything that she was going through, wondering what's going to happen. But she also has a strong faith. And they when they took me out of surgery, they took me to ICU. I was there for a couple of days. I was about one day out of ICU. This is really cool. God was already starting to do something. There was a chaplain who came in to come and minister to me. And for the next 45 minutes, I ended up ministering to him because he was talking about how lonely he was. He didn't know what his purpose was anymore. He didn't know if he was supposed to be staying in ministry. And for the next 45 minutes, God filled me to be able to speak into that man's life, that when he walked out that door, I know that he understood that he had a purpose in this life. But isn't that just like God? God will take some of those moments when the enemy is trying to shove something down our throat, and we look back at the enemy and we go, "You don't get to win. Until God calls me home, I am invincible." So it'll be 5 weeks. This is a Thursday when I'm recording this. So it'll be, tomorrow will be what, the 9th of October, 10th of October. Sunday I'll turn 65 on the 12th. And I do know this to be true. I'm 20 pounds lighter than the last time I saw you. That wasn't intentional, and I'm hoping to put that weight back. But God has been healing my heart inside and out, and I cannot wait to get back out there speaking to men again. Because that passion, that fire that burns within me, it's almost like the rider on the back of a bull and they haven't opened the gate yet. He's in the chute, right? He's like, "Come on, open that thing. Let's do this." That's what's burning within me. I keep going, "Say when. God, let's do this." Men need to know who you are, that they don't need to be afraid, that they have a purpose. You know, this whole chasing giants has really kind of brought me back down to the giant that I really want to be chasing the most is the one who made everything there is. Because when the enemy gets in my face and he tries to whisper his lies, you know, there's two things, right, with fear. One of them can mean something. I think I was told this one time. It means forget everything and run. Or you can look at it as face everything and roar. If you have the God of the universe in you, you don't have to forget everything and run. You can face everything and you can roar because the God of the universe, the Lion of Judah, is in you. God, as I'm sitting here, I can hear the leaves out the window that are blowing in the wind. I can even hear some of them falling and tapping against the window outside. God, I know as I've been going for some walks behind my house, I go past a little strip of woods that's maybe only about a tenth of a mile wide, and my mind immediately goes to the woods. I love deer hunting. This is October. It's one of my favorite months leading into November. And God, you know my passion is twofold. It's reaching men through the venue of the outdoors, and it's also following you. God, being in the woods this time of the year is one of the places that I feel most close to you, but I know that this year, that's going to be put on hold for a little while. But I trust you. And Father, I'm asking the men listening right now, maybe they're struggling with some of these things that have been dropped in their lap. Maybe they're having chest pain and they're afraid to get it checked out. Take that fear away. Maybe it's worried about whether they're going to keep their job, whether they're going to keep their marriage. Whatever is happening in their life, the enemy wants to throw fear and doubt at them. But remind them who you are and whose they are. That until you call them home, they are invincible in you. Father, help us to pick back up the sword when we've fallen down and get back in the game. Because you are in us, we have what it takes to do battle for the hearts of men. God, I want to thank everyone who has come alongside and been praying for me. And Father, I would just pray that you would bless them. Remind us who we are in Jesus' name. Amen. I had reached out to Terry Peer, you know, when this whole thing was going on. And I just want to say a special thanks to Terry and to Lester's feet. When I reached out to Terry and told him what was going on, I was in shock. And Terry messages me back like one sentence, give me 10 minutes. I had no clue what he was doing. He reached out to the board at Lester's feet, and he comes back within a matter of minutes, and he said, Brent, he said, I let everybody know what was happening, and unanimously they voted to, we're going to go ahead and help you for the next couple of months, because we know that the financial stress that's going to be on you guys is something you don't need right now. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. That's how the body of Christ works together. And I just pray that God will do that in each and every one of our hearts, that we will see the need. We will not have fear, and that we will step up. Be who God has called us to be. You are loved.